My guest today, for the next 25 minutes, Barbara Nimri Aziz, resides in New York. She was educated in London, born in Canada, and has a vast experience as a scholar and a resident in many parts of the world. She has spent half of her considerable professional life working in South Asia and in the Arab lands. Dr. Aziz has successfully combined the disciplines of social anthropology. Her PhD was awarded from University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies and Journalism, and draws on both in her writings. From 1989 to 2013, she produced a weekly show on WBAI, Pacifica Radio in New York City, Radio Tahrir, which is on www.radiotahrir.org. That's T-A-H-R-I-R. Remember Tahrir Square, where the Cairo uprising against Mubarak began. She was also founder and executive director of the Radius of Arab American Writers and still produces a regular blog syndicated on counterpunch.org. Between 1978 and the present, Dr. Aziz authored 6 books, 3 of them academic monographs, along with, quote, Swimming Up the Tigris, Real Life Encounters with Iraq, University of Florida Press in 2007. Her most recent book in Arabic is short radio features based on journalism courses she taught in Syria. Welcome, Barbara Nimri Aziz, to Takes on the World.
Yes, Jeffrey, thanks very much. That's quite a nice introduction, and it shows or it indicates maybe how old I am, but I'm still in the struggle.
Well, I probably have a few years on you, and I'm still in the struggle myself. We do it the ways we can. You know, what touched me in your most recent article in Counterpunch, An Impossible Syrian Victory, is that it began with your reaction to hearing on NPR's Morning Edition, as did I, a reporter referring to Syria's victory over ISIS in Palmyra as a city having, quote, fallen back into government hands without even a suggestion that the event marked a major military success over the world's number one target. Please share your thoughts on that and the general response of the U.S. media and the political class to that victory with our listeners.
Yes, Jeffrey. Well, you caught that, too. You were listening to the same news report, I guess, and you caught that sense of disappointment in the reporter's voice, didn't you? That
exactly.
It's fallen back into government hands. My goodness, my goodness.
Can't have that happening, yes. Can we?
Yeah, that's maybe, you know, there's still some value in radio, in that live radio, or at least the voice, the human voice, that we can still pick up what some people might say was a nuance, but to us it was very clear that the reporter reflecting NPR position regarding Syria was very negative. Let me just say, before we talk about that particular event, Tahrir, many people in 2011 learned the phrase Tahrir, and it became associated with that particular 2011 uprising in the center of Cairo. But Tahrir Square, Tahrir means liberation, and Tahrir Square was named in an earlier 20th century liberation of the Egyptian people in their struggle against colonialism. And in many parts of the Arab world, including Iraq, you will find squares and other public places called Tahrir as a recognition and a memory of their earlier revolutions. Anyway, and I had visited Cairo in the 80s, I think it was, and visited Tahrir Square, and remembered the power that the word has for Arab people. And then, so I named my program when it began 1989, Radio Tahrir. So there's a sort of circle for you. Anyway, to go to the media coverage of the victory by the Syrian army, the Syrian government forces, with their ally, Russia. Yes, it was one of several advances that they have made in terms of countering the assaults by ISIS. And as I say in my article, which can be, as you say, found on Counterpunch, for I think it was
April 6th, 1 week ago today.
April 6th, so people can look that up there. It's also on my webpage, radiotahrir.org. And, well, here you have the number one enemy of the world, pushed back. A major victory of, and if people, well, they may not know Palmyra, but Palmyra is in the middle of, it's now a desert, although it was an ancient Roman city two millennia ago. And it was, in terms of, well, I guess strategically, quite an operation because the forces, the Syrian forces, had to advance across deserts, flat deserts. I've been to Palmyra several times, and I know the area. It's 4 or 5 hours' drive from Damascus. And here you had an assault on it over a period. And this was anticipated. You know, there were announcements, mainly I read through RT and the Russian press, that they expected to make that assault on ISIS, and they, it seems, were victorious. And yet it was, you know, reported as if it were a failure in by the Western press, and I'm including the British and the French. And look at here we have so many statements by our Western leaders about their inability or their ideal of still routing ISIS. And here one force or the combined Russian-Syrian allies managed, and it was treated almost as a failure, a mystery. One report I read described this incident and an earlier victory, you can say, over ISIS near the city of Aleppo as mysteries, like how did they do it? And then, as I mentioned in my article, the major, one of, considered the newspaper of record, describing how al-Assad is now somehow, you know, hanging on and a manipulative leader who is using all kinds of methods to push back this Western declared enemy number one. I mean, it's almost comical to read the New York Times and other hear other reports about how now, how could this have happened? And if it happened, it must indicate yet our own portray or understanding of the Syrian leader as a person not to be trusted.
It's interesting. I mentioned in my introductory remarks before I called you that whatever they say about ISIS, it's clear that the hatred or opposition, antagonism toward both Russia, Vladimir Putin, and Bashar al-Assad in Syria trumps their concerns over ISIS when it comes right down to it. And this obviously is proof of it.
It is, and I wish people would recognize this, Jeffrey. Why don't they see it? Why don't they see it? But they have too much confidence, I suppose, in the deluge of data that these newspapers manage to produce. You know, just constant references to their own creations of their demon out there. And as you may know, I mean, there's so much data produced by these major media institutions that just the sheer data, I think, intimidates the public. And they may not read more than the first couple of paragraphs of a whole page on ISIS and on Syria and then conclude the kinds of very, very negative and yet feel informed. I think this is very, very dangerous, that people who rely on limited means of information, because it seems so vast, they conclude that they know. And we have now, you know, the RT, which is in English. They have English as well as other languages.
That's Russia Today. RT stands Russia Today, which you can actually see online.
Yes, and
24-hour news.
You can access it very easily. And even if someone doesn't want to believe it 100%, at least add it to your sources to evaluate what you're being told from, let's say, American, British, and other European sources, Australian, and so forth. But people simply don't do this. It's very troubling at a time when, you know, we all boast about our access to international media. In fact, it is very, very limited, and this adoration and acceptance of these few, maybe we could name them on one hand, print and TV, that really informs the American public. And it's not, you know, it's not people in the so-called, I don't know, in the boondoggles or in these out of the way places in America where we feel, you know, it's the intelligentsia in this country. It's not just the Washington crowd. It's the New York intellectual crowd. It's the professors in our universities, and therefore our students who are swallowing this nonsense. And of course, the result is both the anti-American feeling abroad, but also the decline of respect for this country and democracy, and also of the creation of a very stupid and failed policies on our part. So it's very, very dangerous.
Well, we still have politicians who think that even after failure of the consequences of regime change in Iraq, without which we would not have ISIS today, and the failure of regime change in Libya, without which we would probably not have not only a well-armed ISIS, but also Boko Haram in Africa, still have not learned the lesson and want to have no-fly zone over Syria. As a matter of fact, what's interesting,
right,
maybe comment on the fact that American politicians seem to be ignoring, and when they talk about plans for Syria, which is a sovereign country, we should remember.
Yes. Really?
There's no discussion. They don't even mention the fact of what the Russians and Hezbollah, who is the most hated organization of all, created as a result, of course, of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which one never hears about, which killed at least 15,000 people, 20,000 people, not including those who died at Sabra and Shatila. One gets an image of this organization which, according to, let's say, Hillary Clinton as well as Benjamin Netanyahu, is worse or the same as ISIS. It's quite extraordinary, the
right
propaganda we see about this,
right,
in the U.S. media.
Well, again, people need to go back and look at the origin of Hezbollah, which was against the occupation of their own country by Israel. You know, what happened there in 1982? And that's never mentioned. It was an anti-occupation force. So pretty sad, isn't it, for a country which, again, and I've, throughout my years as a broadcaster at Pacifica WBAI, pointing out that our listeners live in a country where we claim we don't have censorship. Even with the censorship, we have terrific access to a wide variety of sources, not just in French and Arabic. And then we have, of course, now Arabic channels, which have English stations. So, you know, tremendous access through all media. And yet we continue to allow ourselves to be so ill-informed. Now, related to this, Jeffrey, I'd like to, if I may, comment on the atmosphere, I think, that helps promote this ignorance.
Please.
And that is, may I?
Please, yes.
Yeah. And that is, before conflicts arise in states or regions of the world which are probably identified by our policymakers as to be destroyed or to be changed, regime changed down the line somewhere. Syria was one of these countries for many, many years, partly because of Syrian policies which did not comply with British, American, and French, and certainly Israeli interests. A country like Syria had its own idea of who its allies, its priorities, where its priorities should lie in terms of alliances, in terms of economic trade, in terms of their own ideology. And it does. Syria simply was not a puppet and would not be a puppet or even a close ally of the United States. And being a close ally, we know what that means. It means joining the ideology of America against another enemy. And in the case of Syria, to some, Iran was considered for many years, of course, even today, the enemy. And Syria's alliance with Iran, which has nothing to do with the religion of the two leaderships or countries or cultures, it was a regional alliance, geographic as well as related to other countries in the area. And Syria could not be pulled out of that towards the West, and therefore remained on a terrorist list and was sanctioned for, I'm trying to figure out whether it began. It's difficult because there's been so many series of added sanctions on Syria. But I think it began shortly after 1973, which was the war, the 73 war, and therefore related to, of course, to the American alliance with Israel. And sanctions were slapped on Syria at that time, and they've been augmented over the years, partly through the unwillingness of Syria to bend and to change its policy. And then, of course, with the occupation of Israel in Lebanon, you had, as we mentioned earlier, the growth of the Hezbollah party and the Hezbollah military resistance against Israel. And Syria, of course, supported and was occupying during that Lebanon. So there was a strong alliance there against Israel and Israel occupation. Eventually, thanks to the resistance movement in Lebanon, Syria was forced out of South Lebanon. But that was another alliance that could not be tolerated. But anyway, through all this period, and then, of course, Israel occupied Syria itself and still occupies a major portion of Syria, right up to within 100 miles of the capital city, if you can imagine. But part of the embargo, it's economic and it's related to travel and so forth, but it's cultural, and it's media. It's promoted through the media that Syria is a dangerous country. And in fact, if a person, even travel agents, even institutions, if they want to, we see now how institutions are establishing ties with the Cuban institutions after the detente and the new agreements between America and Cuba. And business people are going, and institutions are setting up tours and all kinds of things going on. This was never allowed, not by laws, but by Well, to some degree by laws, because if an institution wanted to set up some kind of tour in Cuba or in exchange of students or other groups, religious and so forth, and they contacted the State Department to find out about visas, or, you know, most institutions do consult the State Department, and they're told, no, this country is on a terrorist list, and it's very dangerous to go there. So while this is absolutely, it is on the American terrorist list, but it's not impossible to go there. It's not impossible, it was not, to obtain a tourist visa. And so people simply stayed away from it. And you found, therefore, the embargo extending to all kinds of cultural exchanges. You could not take a flight direct to Syria, just as you could not return to the United States direct from Syria. And you had very few scholars going, very, very few. People who wrote about Syria tended not to have had any on-the-ground experience with it. Fulbright did have a program, the Fulbright Scholar Exchange Program, which was very intermittent. And, of course, it stopped now. It had started in the maybe around 2003 or 4, and then was interrupted again. And you only had like two. I don't think Peace Corps ever worked in Syria. Of course, Syria did not want American NGOs, for the same reason that today they're unwelcome in other parts of the world, because these NGOs often are intelligence-related agencies, even perhaps Peace Corps. So you didn't, and people writing about Syria really did not know the country, and if they did know the country, the book would not get published. I mean, it's amazing that some of my articles recently on Syria were published, but they're carried by the alternative media. So you didn't have scholarly exchange. You didn't have even tourism. I mean, I've been visiting Syria for over 20 years. Hardly ever meet an American there. And recently, in 2009 to 2012, I was teaching in Syria, and I was also taking an advanced course in Arabic at the University of Damascus, and then also at another private foreign language. By foreign language, I mean Arabic. I mean, Arabic for foreigners. And I met a lot of foreign students from all over the world, from Korea to Japan to Mexico, Turkey, Europe, of course, Australia. Very few Americans taking those courses. Although there was one, I remember, one American university had arranged with the University of Damascus. And in, I'll tell you, one of the courses that I was in, there were two American guys, fairly young, in their, I would say, mid-20s. They made no secret of the fact that they had been Marines in Iraq. Now, you know, they did not hide it. Now, of course, the Syrian, anyone who issues a visa in Syria would know about this, and I don't know why the Syrian government, knowing who these chaps were, allowed them to be there, because this was in 2009, 10, 11. So they may have been agents, but as I say, they didn't hide it. But still, very, very few American tourists or language students in Syria. So there you had this void, and the only source of information we had were generally about Syria was by organizations or institutes like Policy Institute and others, related often to Zionist interests and even directly to Israel, providing information or disinformation, let's say, about Syria. And so it's in that void or a kind of negative image of a place to be feared, one of those enemies, you know, why do they hate us sort of things, don't go there. And definitely, of course, the Syrian intelligence folks are a very scary group. On the other hand, it's no reason to stay away from a country. I mean, American intelligence, as we now know, are also very scary, and there are many parts of the world where we know intelligence services are very active. And still, that should not dismay people and discourage them from getting to know a country before you have the eruption of these terrible conflicts where the lines are drawn, it seems, very clearly. And it is, of course, very dangerous now in Syria. But, you know, there are so many parts of the world, including Iraq, and others where I was privileged to visit. People now apparently don't even go to Egypt in exchange. Of course, you've had these attacks on tourists in Egypt, but you never had these in Syria or Iraq, and people stay away from those countries. And meanwhile, the Americans provide these other avenues. I mean, if you want to go to Morocco, here you've got these monarchies, no democracy there. What about Jordan? No democracy in Jordan, and yet these are now favored places. And not to mention the Gulf states, huge tourist destinations now, very popular. Americans are setting up new universities in Jordan and in the Emirates and other Gulf states, and Qatar and so forth, new museums, and American tourists are flocking to these non-democracies in other parts. So that's part of the whole shift away from places America does not want to exist and to other places and, you know, monarchies that are our friends and do our bidding. And we do theirs as well, or we cooperate with them on certain issues. So what do you think of that?
That was beautiful. You laid it out the way it is. And, of course, those monarchies reward Lockheed Martin, our arms manufacturers, with huge purchase orders of weapons. We continue to be the not the purveyor of violence, as Martin Luther King said, and I quoted him earlier in the program.
King was that?
Martin Luther King said back in 1967 in April that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Mm-hmm. But he actually meant, I think, carrying out of violence, but we're also, in terms of purveying like a armed supermarket, this is one of the ways that the United States arms industry keeps his huge profits, and why the politicians don't even talk about our arms military budget unless they want to talk about enlarging it during the presidential debates. All over the country, they have weapons factories, so every state makes a profit from the death of people all over the world. It's a tragic thing. Most Americans are not aware of this. They're not aware of the history of the people of other countries. I've been in Syria briefly, just going through back and forth back in 1970. Mm-hmm. But I've been in Lebanon a number of times, and people here have no idea what Lebanon is like.
Right. If anything, Americans take these poor people, look at the refugees. Isn't it sad? And isn't it, look at how they've been killing each other for centuries and this kind of thing. Just before we go, though, Jeffrey, I want to mention my book.
Yes.
Swimming Up the Tigris, Real Life Encounters with Iraq, which was finally published in 2007 by University Press of Florida. And it documents a 13-year period in which I was working in Iraq of the embargo there. And we know, many Americans know the effects of the embargo on Cuba, although Cuba has done very, very well in its resistance and self-sufficiency. Iraq did not, and it was a bitter, bitter, brutal killing machine, the blockade against Iraq. So people on my webpage also can find lots of interviews that I did with Syrians, and they just go to my webpage, radiotahrir.org.
Let me say again, That's Radio Tahrir. That's Radio Tahrir.
TAH.org.
And then you will find all this information. And that book sounds very interesting. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and sharing your experiences and your insights, because we don't often hear them from people who have actually been there. Even people who agree with you haven't the experience of actually living in a land.
They've lost a lot.
It's very sad. So, again, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you for being out there and continuing to put on this kind of program, Jeffrey.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being our guest today. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you very much for listening.